Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Dr. Carl, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Very good morning to you, Dr. Howard.
So here's a listener question before we even ask, get to ask you the questions that I want to ask you, is where do birds go to die?
They die anywhere that they happen to fall out of the sky, but the basic rule is this, that nature is bloody in tooth and claw. And so typically, I have been doing bushwalking in Australia. What do you call it in South Africa when you just go for a ramble? Do you call it rambling or bushwalking or bushbashing?
We go bushwalking, I think so.
3, 4, 5, 1, 9. We have a common language, lovely.
We do. More similar than we imagine.
I've been going out in the morning and we've seen a bird dead just at the side of the track. Right. Come back 2 hours later and the bird is practically gone. And you've got to look very carefully to see where the remains of the bird are. So where do they go to die? They just die where they happen to, but then everybody else comes along and eats them really quickly. So there are very few remains left after any significant time.
So that's where the question comes from, is why we don't see more dead birds. But that makes sense because, in fact, they are consumed, which is the way nature intended it.
Intended or evolution just rose across. So that's a whole different evolutionary debate. So I'll follow that one later.
Right. Okay. Let's not go there. So I remember as a kid, we would always be taken to Cape Point on holiday, and we were told incorrectly, of course, that that was the where the Indian and the Atlantic Ocean met, and we would stand there looking to see if we could see the different colors, which we probably could, but it was in our imagination, especially because it wasn't where they met. But why is it that some oceans are different colors to others?
A combination of things related to how dirty the water is. So if there's some runoff from the land, you can get fertilizers or dirt in the ocean. And then the fertilizers can act as a stimulant for the growth of living creatures such as phytoplankton. So if you've got very few phytoplankton, the water is usually kind of bluish. If you're lucky enough to have shallow ocean water with a white sandy bottom, then the blue light reflects up again because the red light is absorbed in the water and turns into heat, but the blue light bounces off the bottom and comes back up and you get that glorious turquoise color. And then every now and then you get that green color, which I found out only recently is actually caused by the phytoplankton. So phytoplankton, what does that mean? Phyto means plant, and plankton comes from the Greek word planetos, meaning to wander. So on one hand, the ancient Greeks would look into the stars at night and see these, that most of the stars stayed where they were night to night relative to each other, but there was about half a dozen of them that wandered across the sky, and they called them planets because they were wanderers. And so in the oceans, we've got these plankton which wander across the ocean, and what they do is make slightly more than half of all the oxygen we breathe. We need them. They're very important for us. And so even though you can't individually see a little tiny phytoplankton, en masse, they create a greenish sort of lovely glow. And then, of course, if you've got clean water, the deeper it is, the darker the blue it is. And then, of course, there's the other thing is that the water is to some degree reflective of the sky above. So when you get a big storm coming across, you get this sort of angry gray looking ocean with big storms whipping up.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is this time of year in South Africa, well, COVID aside, many people go to the bush. They go to the Kruger Park. They go to the other reserves. It's very much part of South African culture. We do this as well. And I still, despite having done this my entire life, have a real fear of elephants. I find them very, very scary. But maybe I need to understand them a little bit better. I wanted to ask you specifically about the elephant's trunk.
It's an amazing device. It's, the elephant is the only one animal that's got this large, long, soft, boneless appendage. And by the way, my understanding of elephants is that you might annoy them by being there, so you should keep out of their way because they might decide to attack you and then they outmass you and they can do bad things to you. Is that vaguely correct, that elephants need to be given a bit of room to do their own thing.
Yeah, so you have to be very, very respectful of an elephant in any of these reserves, because you don't want to get between a mother and her young. You don't want to be around an elephant in must. There's a lot of times that you just need to be very, very cautious.
The thing is that, getting back to their wonderful trunk, mm-hmm. it's very poorly understood, and I was very surprised to find out that the last time we published anything about the anatomy and physiology of the elephant trunk was in the previous century, what? Over a century ago, 1908. My God, that's 112, 13 years ago. Now, the trunk is really bizarre, and it does stuff that we can't fully understand, which is why engineers in the field of robotics, especially the field called soft robotics, are looking at the elephant trunk to see how it works, so that they can come up with stuff in a field called jointless flexibility. But firstly, just to tell you how wonderful the trunk is, on one hand, the trunk can uproot an entire tree, but be so delicate, it can suck up a potato crisp or chip and individually pick up a leaf off a tree, and at the tip, they can make the round tip sort of form two opposable kind of fingers that can grab food. And so, because they've got this air hollow mechanism, they can pick up something and touch it and also smell it at the same time. Now, they don't drink through the trunk. I mean, they could. You could, if you really had to, you could drink through your nose, mm-hmm. and the water would go up and then come down, and you'd be coughing and spluttering and setting off a whole bunch of touch receptors, because there's nothing supposed to be up there except air, you know. Mm. So the elephants can store up to 6 liters of water. They can spray the water. They can blow air through it at 110 dB, which you can hear apparently for kilometers. And this one I was surprised about. The scientists claimed that the elephant trunk can inhale air at speeds up to 540 kilometers an hour. And when I read this in the New York Times article, I thought, oh no, come on, I've got to actually go to the original article, which is called Suction Feeding by Elephants. And they claim 540 kilometers an hour, but they do this not by actually measuring it via Doppler, or having a little sensor that moves across, but just by doing the mathematics and working out the ins and outs. So I'm still skeptical, but that's like 30 times faster than you and I can sneeze, which is about 20 kilometers an hour. It's amazing speed.
And amazing, amazing animals as well. That's unfortunately, Dr. Carl, where we do need to leave it. A fantastic chatting to you, and I look forward to speaking to you next week.